Nobel Prize winner Eric Kandel is a famous neuroscientist, but he's also an art expert. This hour, he joins us to talk about The Age of Insight, his new book on turn-of-the-century Vienna, and the intersection of neuroscience, psychology, and art. For example, have you ever noticed that Gustav Klimt's paintings are full of human cells? Plus, Titanic director James Cameron just dove to the deepest spot on Earth, Challenger Deep, about 7 miles beneath the sea. But he was not the first. Coming up, Navy Captain Don Walsh is here to talk about his historic first ascent to the bottom of the Mariana Trench over 50 years ago. What's it like down there? Some answers and your questions after the break, so stay with us. Science is now sexy. Science has become the theme of TV shows and Broadway plays, film and artwork. And we think it's a real trend, and we've created a whole science and arts section right on our website, entertaining interviews with artists and actors, scientists and celebrities. It's the only one of its kind, and I invite you to check it out at sciencefriday.com/arts. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. My next guest won the Nobel Prize in 2000 for his work on learning and memory, and he really needs no introduction as a neuroscientist. But there is another side to Eric Kandel that you may not know. He is an art collector, an historian of early 20th century art in Germany and Austria, and he says he could have seen that passion as an alternate career path. Kandel's new book, The Age of Insight, The Quest to Understand the Unconscious in Art, Mind, and Brain, takes us back to turn-of-the-century Vienna, the place of his birth, and he writes about the salons there, where artists could mingle with writers and physicians and scientists. Can you think of anywhere that happens today? But this isn't just an art history book. Kandel also gets deep into the science of the mind. What happens in the brain when we see a beautiful work of art? How it affects our emotions? How we recognize objects and faces, too? It is written by a neuroscientist, after all. Eric Kandel is a senior investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute and a university professor at Columbia University here in New York. And if I may add a personal note, he is one of the classiest scientists around. Thank you for joining us again, Dr. Kandel. Good to see you.
Eric, Ira. Eric. It's always a pleasure for me to be here with you.
This book is just terrific. Who knew that you had this whole side of you?
I didn't realize I had this side of me.
Well, how long have you been collecting art?
I've been collecting art for much of my adult life. I started around 1960. And my wife and I really enjoy art a great deal. We don't have a lot of money, so we have works on paper, but we enjoy them a great deal. And I come from Vienna, and I particularly like the period Vienna 1900. Mm. So this is what my book is about.
But best just take a side trip to about Vienna. We'd think that you, who escaped Nazi Austria as a child, would be so interested in going back and collecting artwork.
It's a post-traumatic stress disorder, Ira. It's the way I come to grips and try to master some of the painful moments in my life. Mm-hmm. But I do have enormous admiration for Vienna 1900, which is very different than Vienna 1938. It was a time when, as you indicated, there were no two cultures. People interacted with each other freely. Science was part of the intellectual intercourse of the day. And Jews and non-Jews acted very productively. It was really a magical period. And my hope and that of others in bridging between art and science is to recreate a period like that. Mm-hmm. Our president, Lee Bollinger, sees neuroscience as a bridging discipline. He argues that, in a sense, everybody at the university is working on the mind. And insofar as we understand the biology of the mind better, we can have an impact on economics and decision-making, on art and music, on many areas of the university.
Mm-hmm. And as you say in your book, you talk about unconscious emotions, conscious feelings, bodily expressions, that when people see a great piece of artwork, something's going on in their mind.
Right.
Right? And you want to know what that is.
Exactly. Right.
Are we any closer to understanding what that is?
We are closer than we were before, but a long way from a really satisfying understanding. As you know, in most areas of science, there are long periods of beginning before we really make progress. But I think this is a very rich area. And one of the interesting things is, even though you think that what Gombrich and Riegel called the beholder's share, how you and I respond to a work of art, is an extremely difficult problem in brain biology. And it is. One can, in principle, outline sort of a set of neural circuits that are critically involved and even identify disorders that affect different components of that neural circuit and see how what happens if you knock out, for example, you know, inability to recognize faces, how it affects your response to portraiture. Obviously, if you can't see it, your response is going to be very blunted. Or you can interfere with the emotional response to it or the empathic response to it. So different components of it you can really dissect apart.
1-800-989-8255. We're talking with Eric Handel if you'd like to join us and ask him questions about his book. Also, you can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Let's get into some of the details on your book because it's quite a fascinating book. One of the things you write about is the Zucker – we talked about the salons, the Zucker Candle Salon.
I love that.
Did I pronounce that correctly?
You did it very well. I like that for many reasons. First of all, it was characteristic of Vienna. It was characteristic of many cities in Europe in which ladies, often Jewish ladies, ran salons that brought together people from all walks of life, artists, writers, scientists, business people, politicians, to get together over tea and cakes and talk to one another. And I particularly like the Zucker Candle family because Bertha Zucker Candle, for two reasons. Bertha Zucker Candle's grandson, Emil Zucker Candle, is a major biologist at Stanford. And when I began to write about his grandmother, I called him and he gave me a lot of useful information, invited me out to his house in Palo Alto, and I saw remnants of the Zucker Candle Salon. He had a wonderful Rodin sculpture of Mahler you would kill for.
Wow.
He had some of the artwork she had hanging on the wall. So that's one reason I like the Zucker Candle Salon so much. The other one is his name is Emil Zucker Candle, and his grandfather's name was Emil Zucker Candle. And Emil Zucker Candle, the grandfather, was a close associate of a man called Rokitansky, who's one of the heroes of the book. He was the dean of the University of Vienna Medical School from about 1845 to about 1878, and he revolutionized medicine. He put medicine on a scientific basis. And he had an enormous impact on all of the people I write about, on Freud, on Schnitzler, and on the three artists, Klimt, Kokoschka, and Schiele. And he did it by pointing out that you really don't know anything about a disease state until you've explored it in enormous detail. So if you, particularly in the 1840s, if you examined a patient at the bedside, you would get his history or her history, and you'd listen to their heart and their chest, and you'd hear sounds, but you wouldn't know what was responsible for the sounds. There was no correlation between that and the pathological anatomy. Rokitansky had a privileged position. He was head of pathology, and Vienna was the only hospital in Europe in which every single person who died was autopsied, and the autopsy was done by one person, the head of pathology. So Rokitansky did 30,000 autopsies, not with his own little hands, but with his colleagues. And he collaborated with a great clinician, and so they took the clinical findings at the bedside, the peculiar sounds coming from the heart, and they showed which sounds came from the mitral valve, which came from the tricuspid valve, and if they had any question, they would flow water through the valves and see whether they could simulate the sounds they heard clinically. So they were able to put medicine on a scientific basis through these clinical pathological correlations. And he enunciated a dictum that's really the leitmotif for everything that was to come. He said, truths are hidden from the surface. You have to go deep below the skin in order to understand what's going on. And this is what Freud tried to do. This is what Schnitzler tried to do. This is what Klimt and Kokoschka tried to do. And I argue that these five people independently discovered different aspects of the mind of unconscious mental processes. Now, Freud, you know, clearly was the leader, and he outlined a coherent theory of mind, which was really quite interesting, original, and fascinating. But he missed certain things. He did not know very much about female sexuality. But Schnitzler and Klimt knew an enormous amount. So Klimt, for example, in his drawings, shows women pleasuring themselves without the need of a man. They can be in their own reveries. The historical nude of Western art usually has a mythological woman, you know, Venus or something like that, looking out at the beholder as if she could only satisfy herself if she satisfies the viewer. And she is nude, but she's covering her genitalia. You don't quite know whether this is modesty or whether she's masturbating. With Klimt, there's absolutely no doubt what's going on. And it was done in a elegant, non-pornographic fashion. It's really quite marvelous the way these drawings are done. And different aspects of unconscious mental processes were developed by both Klimt and his later disciples, Kokoschka and Scheele. For example, Klimt knew that if you liberate women's sexuality, you also, in a sense, are liberating their aggression. And the two can be fused. And he has a wonderful painting of Judith and Holofernes, Judith, a Jewish heroine, trying to save her people from Holofernes, who has established a siege around him, gets him drunk, seduces him, and while he's in his drunken state, she cuts off his head. And there are a number of historical depictions of this, and usually, you know, Judith, who's a young widow, a very modest woman, did this out of heroism, was horrified by the deed she did. But in Klimt's drawing, she's in a post-orgiastic phase. She's fondling the head. She's dressed in a beautiful, elegant gown. There's absolutely nothing widowish or modest about her. So, I mean, his ability to really depict many aspects of women's life is fantastic. Mm.
Just fascinating. I mean, I'm talking with Eric Kandel, author of The Age of Insight, The Quest to Understand the Unconscious in Art, Mind, and Brain. And, in fact, you use Klimt on the cover of your book.
Yes, yes.
And she has a dress that is full of cells. The fabric is made out of cells, right?
You picked it up. So Klimt went to the Zuckerkandel Salon. And from Bertha Zuckerkandel's husband, Emil Zuckerkandel, he became fascinated with biology. He began to read Darwin. There was a collection of Darwin books in his library. He looked under the microscope. He saw the difference between sperm and eggs. He went to demonstrations, to dissections, and he incorporates these biological themes into his artwork, as you pointed out.
All right. We're going to take a break and come back and talk lots more with Eric Kandel, author of The Age of Insight, The Quest to Understand the Unconscious in Art, Mind, and Brain, from Vienna 1900 to the present. Site of Dr. Kandel we've never talked about before. And if you'd like to talk with him, our number, 1-800-989-8255. He is an art collector and art historian, and as well as being a Nobel Prize winner. And so he's a neuroscientist. Well, there's a pleasure, but we'll get into that too. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Got a hankering for a bit more conversation? You didn't like what you heard. You want to hear more of it? Well, you can keep the chat going at Science Friday's Facebook page. That's at facebook.com/scifry. Or you can tweet us all week long at scifry. That's at SCIFRI. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about neuroscience, art, the brain, the subject of the new book, The Age of Insight, The Quest to Understand the Unconscious in Art, Mind, and Brain, with Nobel Prize winner Eric Kandel, senior investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute and university professor at Columbia University right here in New York. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. It's hard to imagine the collection, you know, of all these people from different walks of life meeting in salons and discussing.
Wonderful.
Things. Today, it's hard that could happen. Is there any place that you know that – let me go – we have a suggestion on the phone here. Let me go to the Christie in Cedar Ridge, Colorado, is it?
Yeah, it's Cedar Ridge, Colorado. I'm a science writer, and I wanted to say that I think there is something somewhat similar to these salons going on these days. It's happening online, on social media and whatnot. I'm a contributor to a science blog that's called Last Word on Nothing, and we discuss a lot of this sort of –
We lost her. Sorry, Kristen. We just phone dropped out. But she, would she be correct that this is where the talent?
I'm not sufficiently familiar with that, but I can well understand it. I mean, one of the wonderful things about internet is it's like a salon. It brings people together from different intellectual walks of life. Also, we're trying to recreate this at Columbia to some degree, and I think other universities will do it. There will be programs that will bridge neuroscience to other disciplines.
Mm-hmm. Did these people all know each other?
Yes.
They did?
Yes. They all knew each other. And, for example, Freud said he purposely avoided Schnitzler, even though he knew him and he read his work, because he felt that Schnitzler, through his intuition, figured out a lot of the things that Freud discovered only after hard work with patients.
Wow.
But he certainly knew him and he knew of him, yes.
Mm-hmm. Why do scientists need to talk to artists? And why do artists need to talk to scientists?
Well, scientists certainly need to talk to artists because they want to fill their life with beauty. And it's inspiring to be able to go to a good exhibition and see great works of art, to interact with artists, and also to try to understand the nature of art, how we respond to it, how the creative process works, is one of the great goals of science. In addition, one would like to think that artists also benefit from what neuroscientists can bring about. For example, they certainly learned a great deal when the nature of color was dissected and we realized how colors are put together. They learned a great deal in the Renaissance. Leonardo da Vinci studied the human body, did autopsies in order to see how the bones relate to one another so you can get a more realistic depiction. And one would hope that as people understand what happens in the brain as one responds to art, as one creates art, they would be able to use those ideas to create new art forms or at least to more effectively influence certain emotional states in the brain.
Freud actually wrote about Da Vinci.
He wrote about Michelangelo. He wrote two very interesting papers, but they were really more fiction than they were fact. He himself said these were not his best works. He tried, rather than try to analyze the work of art, he tried to analyze the artist.
Right.
The artist had been dead for some time, could not free associate to his interpretations and in any way falsify them. And there were some instances in which Freud didn't quite know all the facts right. So these were not great works. What really happened as a Freud contemporary were the art historians got interested in the problem. And a guy called Alois Riegel, who was the head of the Vienna School of Medicine, of art history, argued we have to become more scientific in art history. And he thought that psychology is the discipline that should be incorporated into it. And he thought, what is the problem we want to solve? And then he realized the critical problem in art is how the person who views it responds to it. If you think of it, it's the most obvious thing in the world. Why does the painter do it? He doesn't do it just for himself. He wants people to look at it. And Riegel pointed out that the beholder's share is critical to the completion of a work of art. And if you think of it, Ira, you look at a painting. It's two-dimensional. You know that it's two-dimensional. It's a flat surface. And yet your brain is willing to allow your imagination to wander to see it as three-dimensional. So you're being tricked by the artist to think there's a perspective there, there's a distance there. Even ahead, when you look at it, you see it as a three-dimensional thing. And there's a part of you that feels this to be completely real, but there's another part of you that knows this is what your brain is doing. I give you an example. If I paint you while I'm looking at you, and I put your painting up on the wall, and I walk around it, your eyes will follow me. It's a common experience. I'm sure you've had this when looking at certain works of art. If I put up a sculpture of you in the same position and walk around it, your eyes will not follow me. And that is, I create a fiction out of the painting because I have to in order to create Ira Flatow looking three-dimensional. And part of that is that the eyes follow you. With a sculpture, it is three-dimensional. No fiction is necessary.
Quite fascinating. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Steve in Alexandria, Virginia. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Hi there.
I was intrigued with this when you mentioned Vienna, because some of the best science art that I've seen has been there, and that was at the Medical Museum, which has a fantastic collection.
Fantastic collection.
Of these wax
models, absolutely,
correct,
yes.
Beautiful, from the 1700s, I believe.
Absolutely,
and
yes.
And what's so fascinating about some of them is that they represent the, I guess, very anatomically correct things like the lymph system, et cetera, in life-size images of human beings that look like they're in absolute agony because the skin has been ripped off of them.
That...
I was wondering, I just found that it'd be an absolutely spectacular use of art and combination with science. And actually, I think it had a very practical value then, because they couldn't quite justify doing all the dissections of the human body, I think, at that time. I'm not sure. I was wondering if you had any insight into that.
Vienna was one of the places in which autopsy was permitted quite early. The church allowed this in Austria. Well, it didn't in many countries of the world. But that museum is world famous in large part because of its extraordinary collection. And people came from all over to see that. And some of those things were exported to other places. They were just wonderful anatomical demonstrations that students used in order to study the body. I agree with you. It still is a very fine museum in the history of medicine.
Mm-hmm. You have a great collection in your book and a gorgeous color in your book also. Are there places we can see this artwork, any collections or exhibits that...
Well, the Neue Gallery, of course, is in New York the best. There are two museums in Vienna that specialize in this. One is called the Opera Belvedere, and I want to come back to that in a moment, and the other is the Leopold Museum. The Opera Belvedere is the upper story, or not the upper story, the upper building of a beautiful property which has a lower building as well, lower down in the campus. And the campus lower down has a fantastically interesting collection that actually ties in with the upper one. It has a collection of a sculptor by the name of Messerschmidt. Messerschmidt was a psychotic sculptor in the period of about, I may have this a little bit wrong, about 1780 to 1790, he made, one doesn't know how many, about 50 to 60 heads, most of them his own, looking in the mirror, of different facial expressions and distortions designed to ward off the evil spirits. They made a fantastic impact. Bertha Zuckerkandel had two of them. A number of people collected these, and they had an impact on Expressionist painting. Expressionist painting takes images and distorts it. It's sort of a fusion of caricature and high art. Mm-hmm. When you exaggerate something, you know, one responds more dramatically to it. And it's, you see this in the Messerschmidt head. And Kokoschka started off as an Art Nouveau painter like Klimt, but he did a sculpture called Myself as a Warrior that looks exactly like a Messerschmidt, and I would guess he may have been influenced by Messerschmidt, which was his first expressionist work of art, a powerful exaggeration of his face. Not only that, but Kokoschka began to use, as Van Gogh had pioneered, the use of color in an arbitrary fashion. So not just to depict nature, but to depict emotion, if you wanted to make the ears red or the fingers red or something like that. And it was a tremendous transformation. And an architect by the name of Lowe's saw this and saw a new art form emerging and told him, this is what you've got to do. Don't do any more Art Nouveau work. Klimt is great. He did it. You do something different. And for the next decade, he did magnificent portraits of other people that have made a tremendous impact, in which he really developed his expressionist ideas of trying to see unconscious mental processes in other people.
How did you not go into this? The way you – the passion and knowledge.
I love
50 years you've been doing this.
I'm glad. There's nothing like science.
What was the decision? Did you actually have a crossroad, a point in the road you had to decide between the two?
Not between those two.
Yeah.
I'm saying this in retrospect,
right,
that I could do it. But I think the time I made my decision, I was not as passionately involved in art as I am now. My choice was psychoanalysis versus neuroscience. Mm-hmm. And my God, was that a wise decision. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for all of us.
Well, I don't know for all of us. Certainly for me.
Well, you anything learning? You've been involved with sea slugs for so long. Is there anything new to learn about sea slugs?
Unending. I'm now studying how memory is perpetuated, how you remember your first love experience for the rest of your life.
You learn that in a sea slug?
Why not? They make love. How do they reproduce, right? In fact, they're hermaphrodites. They have the best of all possible worlds.
So what are you studying there? Give us
a little bit more about it. There is a protein at the synapse that is thrown into activity when you remember something for the long term. And the function of that protein is to perpetuate that change indefinitely. And the way that protein works is that it's a self-perpetuating protein. This has been described by Stanley Prusiner. It's called prion mechanism. And in Stanley's case, it kills the cell. So when it goes into a self-perpetuating state, it destroys the cell. Many other prion-like mechanisms have been described since then, and they either kill the cell or the protein becomes dead. This was the first description of a protein being thrown into the self-perpetuating state in which is the normal it is a normal function of the protein to be like this. It's completely healthy.
Wow.
It's quite interesting.
That is different, isn't it?
It is very interesting.
And how does that help with memory or remember what we're doing?
What it does is it translates messenger RNAs at the synapse. So when you grow a new synapse, you've got to continue to produce material to keep that synapse alive, that new synapse. And what you do is you have a machinery for local protein synthesis. This regulates that machinery. And if you keep it going indefinitely, which you need, this is the way you get it done.
Wow. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. Learning all kinds of new things today, talking with Eric Kandel, The Age of Insight, The Quest to Understand the Unconscious in Art, Mind, and Brain. And this It's a gorgeous book.
Thank you.
It's so filled with they allowed you to do it the right way. You know, it's so I talked to authors, they wouldn't let me do this, they wouldn't let me do that. Gorgeous photographs of the brain and the plates and things.
Random House did a fantastic job with this.
Yeah.
Kate Medina, my publisher, is just marvelous on this.
And is there a follow-up? Are we going to have an act two to this? Or is this any more art, any more writing about artwork or in your mind?
Not at the moment.
It's been I can see the effort, how long it must have taken.
It took me a long time.
To go into
it,
this.
It actually has an interesting beginning.
Yeah.
This is a digression, if you don't mind.
No, that's what we're here for.
So in about 1982, I got an honorary degree from the University of Vienna Medical School. And they asked me to give a talk on behalf of the three of us who were getting an honorary degree. And I first thought I was going to relive 38-39 period when I was treated so terribly. And then I said to myself, don't be Ishmagegi. There's lots of time to express your disappointment. This is, they're honoring you, be gracious. So I thought, what would I do? And I thought I would do something in the history of the Vienna School of Medicine, what it contributed. And this is where I discovered Rokitansky. Mm-hmm. Then on a later occasion, I belonged to a very nice club in New York called the Practitioners Club. I'm not a practitioner, but I somehow belong, that meets six times a year in the wintertime for dinner. And we take turns giving talks. And I thought I would give it on my passion, Viennese Expressionism. And the talk went over fairly well. And when it was over, I realized there's a connection between my lecture in Vienna and this, and that got me going many years ago. And when I had a break more recently, I decided I would start in on that.
Mm. And you're still doing research with your wife also?
I've started recently after 55 years of marriage. We thought we'd put it in the line and we collaborate together. Not an easy thing to do, but very, very enjoyable for the two of us.
What are you looking into together?
Denise has pioneered the study of how kids get involved in drugs. She's a wonderful epidemiologist. Mm-hmm. And she was the first one to point out that kids don't get involved with heroin or cocaine. They start with smoking or drinking, which she called the gateway drugs. Mm-hmm. And so she wanted, after a while, to know, is this just a correlation or is this a causative mechanism? So we explored it together. We used mice and we asked, does it make a difference whether you give nicotine first and then cocaine or cocaine first and then nicotine. So when we gave cocaine first, we found we dramatically enhanced the effect of cocaine.
Wow.
Give nicotine, unbelievable. If you give cocaine first, no effect on nicotine. So it's unidirectional. The gateway drug tremendously enhances. And we think that one of the reasons people may get hooked on cocaine is because the needs, once you examine the data, found that most of the people who start cocaine are smoking at that time. And this effect really catches you.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And we figured out how it works in a behavioral sense, physiological sense, gene expression. We really analyzed it. Amir Levine was the guy who led this project in my lab, did a superb job.
So nicotine is an entry level to cocaine?
Yes. Addiction. Now people are saying there's multiple reasons for giving up nicotine. Nora Volker, for example, has really thought this is a key finding. She's head of NIDA.
Yeah. Yeah. Eric, thank you.
Pleasure
Good
to be
luck
here,
to
always.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you. With the true Renaissance man, Eric Kandel, author of The Age of Insight, The Quest to Understand the Unconscious in Art, Mind, and Brain, also senior investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, university professor at Columbia University here in New York. Happy holidays to you.
Happy holidays to you, and thank you very much. You're very gracious.
You're always welcome back anytime you would like. After the break, we're going to go deep, deep down into the Pacific, to the bottom of the Mariana Trench. Wonder what it's like there, 7 miles below the sea level. We're going to find out from the first person who was ever there. Still around to tell us about it. So stay tuned. We'll be right back after this break. Ira here with a quick reminder to upgrade your iPhone and iPad app. We're adding all kinds of new features. We're making the app easier and more enjoyable to use. Flora's videos look just gorgeous on the iPad. You've made suggestions, we've listened to them, and over the coming days, please check iTunes and search under the keywords Science Friday. A newer, better app is waiting for you to download on iTunes. And we haven't forgotten you Android users. The updated Android app will be right behind. Now back to the show. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. What's to be found at the very, very bottom of the ocean, in the deepest recesses of the Mariana Trench, right out there in the South Pacific? Earlier this week, director James Cameron, the man behind Avatar and Titanic, he went down there solo in a tiny sub, and here is what he saw. I'll tell you right now, he was down there, and he was able to come back, and when he came back, he told us all what was going on down there. He had conducted a news conference, and we'll get to that in a minute. Before we get to that, let me introduce to you Captain Don Walsh, because although Cameron went down there, he's just one of two living people to have visited the deepest gash in the earth. The other man went 52 years ago in 1960 and has been an advisor and mentor to Cameron on this trip, and he's here with us today. Captain Don Walsh is an oceanographer, honorary president of the Explorers Club, president of International Maritime. He joins us by phone from Waikiki. Welcome to Science Friday, Captain.
Thank you, Ira. It's good to speak with you.
Tell us about that adventure. You went down there, 52 years ago in 1960?
Yeah, it was January 23rd, 1960. We had been operating the U.S. Navy bathyscaph on test dives at Guam for about 5 months, each dive being progressively deeper to find out the moods and modes of the Trieste, a rather radical craft for its time. And at that time, it was like only two airplanes in the world, or only two of these manned deep submersibles in the world. The French Navy had one, and our Navy had one.
Yeah.
We culminated that dive series then in January of 1960 with a dive to 24,000 feet, and then about 10 days later, the dive to the deepest place in the world ocean.
And what did you see? What did you see when you got down there?
Well, just before we landed, we spotted what we thought was a flatfish, a white flatfish, like a halibut or a sole, about a foot long. And that was quite a sighting, if true, of a higher-order marine vertebrate at such a great depth. And it was a bottom-dwelling type of fish, so it meant that it was where it belonged, and that there was food down there and sufficient oxygen to support it. Now, Jacques Picard, who was my co-pilot and son of the inventor of the bathyscaph, Professor Auguste Picard, he and I were not ichthyologists. We were engineers. We were, if you will, test pilots of this vehicle, trying to prove out its capabilities. So in the subsequent years, we've been advised by all kinds of scientists that we didn't see that. Yeah, after we landed, though, we stirred up the bottom sediment, which was very fine, very granular, and it remained in suspension for the full 20 minutes we were down there. It was like sitting in a bowl of milk. So we did not get any images on our dive. And that was stirring up sediment was not unusual. Every dive you do when you land, but there's a subtle current that would move that sediment away from the window, and you could make pictures. In this case, it did not happen. And so the first images ever made of the deepest place in the ocean were actually made 25 years later by a Japanese, 35 years later, by a Japanese unmanned submersible called Kaiko, or a Japanese word for trench.
Mm-hmm. Well, I held playing back the clip because I wanted to hear you describe what you saw. Now we have a little clip of James Cameron, who just came back, and we have a clip about what he saw when he went down there.
When I came down, I landed. It was a very, very soft, almost featureless plane. And it just went out of sight as far as I could see. The Challenger Deep, which is only a small part of the Mariana Trench, is something like 50 times the size of the Grand Canyon. So, you know, this is a vast frontier down there that's going to take us a while to understand.
Now, can you relate to what he saw? Or were you in a different part of the trench?
No, absolutely. The actual Challenger Deep consists of really three deep places, but generically they're called Challenger Deep, and all of about equivalent depth over, say, an axis of about 30 miles. What he said is quite correct. He had the advantage, though, that with modern technology, 50 years later, batteries and modern sensors and equipment, he could stay down there. So he could not only wait out the cloud of sediment, if you will, but he could move around. So he just waited out the initial cloud from landing, and then was able to make direct observations, something we were unable to do.
Cameron is working with a team of scientists to solve some of the mysteries of the deep, and one of the researchers who's working with him is with us now, Doug Bartlett, chief scientist in the Deep Sea Challenge. He's also professor of marine microbial genetics at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography at UC San Diego. He joins us by satellite phone from the middle of the Pacific. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Bartlett.
Hi, Ira. It's great to be here. Hi, John.
Hi. Good. Why don't you come home?
Well, it's pretty nice out here. Here we are camped out in the Ulithi Atoll, which is within Yap, a state in the Federated States of Micronesia. It's a pretty beautiful place out here, and we're getting ready to steam out once again to the Challenger Deep.
And what is the purpose, what is the aim of doing this?
Well, as Don and as you heard Jim say, this is a large area. This is a significant portion of our biosphere, the deep sea in general, not hadal environments in particular so much. But these are places of extreme adaptation. They may be inverted islands of biodiversity, places down deep where distinct life forms exist, and would like to know a lot more about who's down there and what are they doing, how do they influence Earth's biogeochemical cycles, and what kinds of extreme adaptations do these life forms have. So at the biological level, those are some of the questions we'd like to address. And, of course, there's the issue of why is this big gash down there in the Mariana Trench in the Challenger Deep? What is the subduction process that accounts for that great trench?
You know, it's hard to believe that more people have walked on the moon than have actually been down to the deepest part of the ocean.
That's correct. 12 people have been on the moon, and only 3 have been to the deepest place in the ocean.
And Doug, did you guys put a chicken down there in one of the trenches?
We did during some of the engineering work that was going on in the New Britain Trench. We did some experiments with bait. It's useful to attract organisms to landers or to the submersible, and we did some work with chickens, and we had a whole chicken in one trap when we deployed it. And when we recovered it, it was completely deboned. There was just no meat there at all. It was just bone. It was as if scarab beetles had gotten a hold of this chicken and gnawed it all the way to the bone. It was very impressive. What we had found were these large amphipods. Amphipods are crustaceans. They're sort of like shrimp, and amazing abilities to smell out food sources in the deep sea. And they had been attracted by the smell of the chicken and had devoured all of the meat. It was quite a sight.
Captain Walsh, you had an unusual event happen on your descent, did you not? Something unexpected occurred?
We had several. That was unusual was usual, if I can mix the metaphor. Yeah, at about 30,000 feet, we had a non-pressure boundary acrylic window crack. We didn't know what it was at the time. We had this huge bang, and the outside pressure is 5 tons per square inch, so that if there'd been a failure of a pressure boundary, that is our cabin, we would have been dead before we even knew it, if you will. And we looked at all our gauges and such, and everything seemed to be normal. We didn't know what the heck it was, but we just decided to go ahead and proceed with a dive. And then once we got on the seafloor, I was able to do an inspection at my leisure, if you will, and I discovered the crack in this window. But it was not mission-limiting in the sense that it was a violation of pressure boundary. It may have affected our ability to get out of the cabin once we got back to the surface. Mm-hmm. As it turns out, we were able to get out and get topside while we were afloat on the surface.
Doug Bartlett, Jim Cameron was talking about almost describing the bottom of the ocean there as looking like so barren, like the surface of the moon. I think in one interview he described it as like being on another planet. Why are we not seeing the giant tube worms and stuff that we normally associate with deep water places?
This is a oligotrophic or low nutrient deep sea environment in the Challenger Deep. The New Britain Trench was much more productive, and so I think that accounts for some of the difference between the trenches. But with regard to hydrothermal vents and cold seeps, these are places where there's lots of energy and there's lots of biomass, and you have all these exotic and charismatic life forms like tube worms and clams. Off of the trench in the forearc of the Mariana, there are some amazing seeps and hydrothermal vents, and you can find liquid CO2 and liquid sulfur and some pretty exotic extreme places. But down at great depth in the Mariana Trench, where there are very few nutrients, along Jim's transect, we saw amphipods. There were some of these smallish amphipod crustaceans, but not much beyond that. And I think it just relates to how little productivity exists in the overlying waters. There's not a whole lot of photosynthesis that's taking place in the shallow waters above the trench.
So are the living things down there just depending on what falls down that they can eat, like your dead chicken you sent down there? They're waiting for stuff to come down and eat it from above?
I think that's true. I think they're largely dependent on the particulate organic matter that makes its way down deep. Now, some of the organisms, the microorganisms, are able to fix carbon, and they probably get energy from unusual sources. So, for example, during some mineralization processes, hydrogen can be produced, and some of the organisms down there are undoubtedly living off of hydrogen. And so at the microbial level, there are diverse physiologies that may not be so dependent on the particulates, but overall, I would suggest that the ecosystem is dependent on particulate organic carbon and things like chickens or whales or large carcasses coming down from above are manna from heaven.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. Talking with Doug Bartlett from Scripps Institution of Oceanography and Captain Don Walsh, who's honorary president of the Explorers Club. president of International Maritime Incorporated. In the next dive, Captain Walsh, in the first dive, did you advise Jim about how to take this dive and what to see and give him general advice?
Well, he's most generous in saying that I had some advisory role. My advice, just before he shut the lid, the hatch, that is, on his sub to go down, I said, Jim, today you move from being an adventurer to an explorer. Have fun. That was my advice. Have fun.
Doug, was it fun, Doug?
Oh, I think all of the dives that Jim has been involved with have been exhilarating to him. To the engineers and the other personnel here on the Mermaid Sapphire ship, the support ship for the submersible, it's just thrilling, absolutely thrilling to see what Jim has done. After every dive, there's an opportunity to review some of the high-definition filming associated with it, and some of the images are just stunning, with all of the LED lights and the high-definition cameras, 3D cameras, macro and wide-angle lenses. The views are just simply amazing. I think Jim's analogy to being on another planet when he went down to the Challenger Deep, I think when all of us have a chance to see this in an IMAX movie or see this at home in a documentary, we'll be amazed at the beauty of it all.
And we have a clip of it on our website at sciencefriday.com about some of the stuff that has been seen. And, yeah, we can't wait to see it because, as you say, there are two fascinating things about that area, about that Earth under the water. One is the life that's down there, and one is how the heck did a rift in the Earth's crust open up to create this, it's 50 times the size of the Grand Canyon?
That's correct.
That's right. You know, we have a geologist here, Ira, on the cruise, and she's written, Patty Fryer is her name, from the University of Hawaii, and she's written about this big gash and why it exists. And I think what Patty would tell you in terms of why is the Challenger Deep so deep is, number one, when you look at the Earth's surface and the various crustal plates, oceanic and continental plates, The part of the Pacific plate near the Challenger Deep is the very oldest plate, and by being old, that makes it dense, and by being dense, that makes it more amenable to going down deep. As one plate goes underneath another during the process of plate tectonics, the denser plate goes deep, and the denser it is, it'll go even deeper. Also, when one plate goes underneath another, sometimes it gets scraped, and sediment gets built up at that interface between the two plates, and that decreases just how deep the trench is, and there's very little of that happening in this case. And then finally, at the Challenger Deep, there seems to be a tear in the downgoing plate, and that tear allows it to take a steeper angle, and it also influences the structure of the overriding plate. Yeah. And so for those three reasons, and it's probably more to it than that, but at least what I can gather from talking to Dr. Fryer, those three reasons account for much of why the Challenger Deep is so deep.
And it's and you know, we talk about going into outer space, but there's so much to learn about our own planet right here. It's amazing. I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Doug Bartlett, Chief Scientist of the Deep Sea Challenge, also Professor of Marine Microbiology Genetics at Scripps in UC San Diego. Captain Don Walsh, Oceanographer, Honorary President of the Explorers Club and President of International Maritime. Thank you both, and good luck to you, and we wait to see those films come back, as they used to say. Stay healthy and report back when we're ready to have a look.
Thanks, Ira.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Our program senior producer is Annette Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora is our multimedia editor. Associate senior producer is Christopher Intagliata. Namisha Serene Anand is our producer. Luis Quevedo, our Spanish language producer. Sam Flato, our production assistant. Neil Rausch, our technical director. Spinning the dials here is Manoli Weatherall. for our program today. And if you missed any part of it, go to iTunes, subscribe to our podcast. Danielle Dana is our executive director. Our web editor is Leslie Taylor. Our manager of new media is Carl Flato. And Annie Nero is our development associate. Our iTunes app is by Pastime Software.